From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And today, Turkish officials said the three suicide bombers who killed more than 40 people at Istanbul's Atatürk airport were from Kyrgyzstan, Russia, and Uzbekistan. Their nationalities and other evidence found in an apartment in Istanbul are part of the reason officials say they are convinced that ISIS is behind the attack. NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston has been following this and joins us with the latest. Hi, Dina.
Hi there.
Well, what are you finding out today about what we know about the attack and the attackers?
Well, we spoke to two officials who were briefed on the investigation, and they say they believe the three suicide bombers were among dozens of young men who came into Turkey from Raqqa about a month ago. Now, we had heard about this from our intelligence sources weeks ago, that there had been this credible evidence that ISIS had what they called forward deployed about two dozen fighters to Turkey in May. And that's why you were hearing about enhanced security measures across Europe. The feeling was that ISIS had moved these fighters into Turkey in plans of having them go on to Europe and attack there during the summer vacation season. And officials now believe that the ISIS leaders made clear that Turkey should be on the target list as well. ISIS leadership in Raqqa has been stepping up the rhetoric against Turkey, and clearly that has ended up with this attack on the airport earlier this week.
And as we said, the attackers have been identified as being from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. Was that surprising to officials?
Not really. I know that ISIS is seen as an organization of Arab extremists, but in fact, there are literally thousands of Russians who have gone to Syria and Iraq to join the group. Russia is providing more recruits to the group even than the French. The government in Moscow has talked about some 5,000 Russians going to join ISIS. U.S. officials say the figure's probably closer to several thousand. There was a trove of papers that was picked up by the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. They were ISIS documents that were found on the battlefield. And in those documents, in the materials, there was like a roster of fighters with their names, next of kin, that sort of thing. And there were more Russians on that list than there were Tunisians or Saudis. And then when it comes to Uzbeks, the Uzbeks were the forces who basically have been fighting in Fallujah. So they're considered among ISIS's most battle-hardened fighters. And one of the most famous ISIS leaders is, in fact, a guy who is from Chechnya. He was known as Omar the Chechen, and he was in a lot of the ISIS propaganda. He was considered the guy who ran the prison where those Western prisoners were, who were eventually beheaded. He had this red hennaed beard, and he was in a lot of the ISIS propaganda and very well known. He was killed in a drone strike in March.
So, Dina, what do we know at this point about what exactly happened on Tuesday at the airport in Istanbul? What more are we learning about the actual attack?
Well, they're learning a lot of things, investigators are, because they finally have the time to go through these volumes and volumes of surveillance video that they have. They have video of the attackers arriving at the airport by yellow taxi, and then they apparently opened fire almost right away. A security official had asked for ID before allowing them into the terminal, and this gunman just pulled a gun out of his suitcase and opened fire and then detonated his vest outside. Then there was a second attacker who came into the arrival hall and just started shooting. And a third man allegedly went downstairs into the departure lounge and did the same thing. All three of them were wearing suicide vests, so they started by shooting and then ignited their vest before they could be caught.
And the idea of that first attacker detonating outside was to draw attention away so the others could get in, or is that what officials are thinking?
They're thinking it has something to do with that. And also, you know, as everybody started running away from him, it was easier for the other two men to sort of fan out and go to other places.
And authorities raided an apartment last night as well. What did they find there in Istanbul?
Well, this was an apartment where they believe that the attackers had been staying for about a month. Our sources say that the authorities found a Russian passport there, but it's still unclear whether the Russian passport is a real Russian passport or was just put there in hopes that they would find it. And this is what happened in the Brussels airport case as well, that they got a tip that got them to the apartment. But what's different about this case is that they expected to find chemicals and precursors of a sort of bomb-making factory there in the apartment, and they didn't find any of that. We're not entirely sure what they found, but they found enough to make them think that this attack had actually been commanded or was a direct result of people in Raqqa telling these attackers what they needed to do. And it's interesting that there weren't chemicals in the apartment, because that suggests, at least for now, that those suicide vests came in from Raqqa or Syria with these bombers.
That's NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston with the latest on the investigation into what happened in Istanbul at the airport in that attack. Dina, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, let's go now to San Francisco, where this week people have been hearing a lot about the city's homeless. A big problem there as high-technology workers have moved in and driven housing prices skyward. On average, a one-bedroom apartment in that city rents for more than $3,000. Now, you might remember we talked to media leaders about a plan to team up to cover the homeless together. Well, it happened this week.
Today, ABC 7 News is partnering with more than 70 other media outlets to highlight the growing homeless situation in San Francisco.
Together, we're calling on the city to do something about it.
And the San Francisco Chronicle ran a letter to city residents on Sunday saying the situation would disgrace any government, but in the progressive capital of the nation, it is unconscionable. NPR media correspondent David Falkenflik has some thoughts. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
Well, we talked to some leaders a while back, as we said, and we heard that this all started with some reporters and editors sitting at a bar having a drink, and the idea was hatched. But tell us more about how it was carried out.
Well, you're seeing it play out in recent days on the airwaves, on online, on the pages of publications, as you just heard, of more than 70 what we would think of as competing news organizations, and they really run the gamut. You've got the San Francisco Chronicle. You've got local TV stations. You've got the public radio stations KLW, Mother Jones, the left-of-center crusading magazine. But you've also got other entrants like BuzzFeed, which has a strong presence in Silicon Valley and in Northern California. California, and Business Insider, and they're approaching it in different ways. They're doing stories about what the city's done in the past. They're trying to identify the problem currently for the 6,600 homeless in a city of about 800,000+ people. They're trying to figure out things that work and things that haven't, and they are finding different ways to do that. Business Insider, one example, said, you know, it's probably unfair to blame this on the infusion of so many tech workers in San Francisco, but many people there feel there's a connection between the homelessness, the lack of affordable housing for many working people there, and the huge infusion of well-paid tech workers there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to bring Jeremy in here for a second, because yesterday, Jeremy, you reported on how some newspapers in Illinois all got together to make a statement with their covers about the budget crisis there. What did
right.
they say?
Dozens of them actually put editorials in their paper at the same time saying, enough, there's been a budget crisis. It's been going on for a long time between the Republican governor and the Democratic legislature. The newspaper said enough, and about a dozen of them did it right on the front page of the paper.
Yeah. So, David, what do you think about this? Are we seeing a trend?
Well, you know, this reminds me of stuff that happened in the 1990s. There was a movement called civic journalism, where news organizations were supposed to identify the problems and at times identify the answers. In this case, you're seeing the news organizations unify to say this is not acceptable. What they're not doing is unifying and say this is what must be done, and the media writ large is dictating the terms to the mayor. What they are saying is, here are ways that have worked. Here are ways that haven't, and they are all bringing such an intense attention to this issue that they're forcing public officials there to put it at the top of their agenda, in a sense doing what we expect the media to do in perhaps a less prominent way on a day-to-day basis.
Well, it may help in covering, you know, getting something done about this intractable problem of homelessness in San Francisco, but it may also help the media, which lately always needs help. I want to make sure we get your thoughts on another issue. The CNN hiring of Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. Now, when he was first fired and he had sort of his exit interview on CNN before he was hired by CNN, he was unbelievably complimentary about Donald Trump.
It's such a privilege and an honor to have been a very small part of this, to learn and experience what he's been able to achieve and the electoral success that he has had. It's been truly amazing.
Well, now that he's been hired, there are reports that women and Latinos in particular at CNN were very upset because of Donald Trump's comments. And here's his representative coming on board at CNN. But also others like conservative commentator Jeff Jacoby, who said, or Jacoby rather, he's a good friend, I can't believe I mispronounced that, who said that because Lewandowski signed a non-disclosure agreement with Donald Trump, he'll be unable to cover him. You know, he can't disclose or say anything negative about him. Your thoughts?
you know, there is the sense of, well, is he going to tell us truly what happened behind closed doors? But theoretically, that's, you know, what CNN would like to get from him. But in reality, what you want from a pundit, if we're going to go to the bother of paying somebody who has such close ties and is so immediately, you know, only walked a few days earlier out of the campaign, you want him to be able to say, this is how Donald Trump thinks. This is how he acts. This is where his impulses are. This is where he's headed. And my question is less about the nondisclosure of what happened before, but of the candor of what will happen subsequently. And let me add one other thought. Mm-hmm. You know, the real problem to my mind of Lewandowski is the contempt that he showed time and again for reporters in the press and trying to do their jobs in covering Trump. Yes, Trump was by far the most available candidate to the press, including CNN, of any major candidate we've seen in a long time. But Lewandowski's statements, his actions, the way he behaved towards Michelle Fields and sort of bruising her arm and trying to pull her away from Trump, it leads to a pattern that suggests real hostility to the press, not somebody you want to put on your payroll at one of the nation's leading news organizations.
And on the other hand, his backers could say he's just the person you need, because if he's a critic of the press, maybe that's what you need under your roof. But we'll see. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks as always.
You bet.
There's a new documentary in theaters tomorrow called Life Animated. It picks up where Ron Suskind's 2014 book of the same name left off, telling the story of how Suskind and his wife and their older son Walt used Disney films to communicate with his younger son Owen, who has autism, and how Owen, who's now a young man, has grown up and moved into his own apartment.
I started a Disney club so I can get to know more people and they can be around me, so I can be more popular. Shannon? It worked.
Roger Ross Williams is the director of Life Animated, and he joins us. Roger, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And we're also joined by the executive producer and the author of the book, Ron Suskind. Ron, welcome to you.
Well, nice to be here, Jeremy.
And the star, Owen, is also with us. Owen, great to have you as well. Welcome. Thank you.
Glad to be here, too.
Well, and Ron, I want you to just take us back for people who don't know this story. And of course, they can listen to our original interview that you and I did a couple years ago about your book at hereandnow.org. But just remind us how this all started.
Okay, so Owen is about 2.5. He starts to lose speech. And after a few months, his 200-word vocabulary for a 2.5-year-old is down to a single word, juice. He can't make eye contact. He walks like someone with their eyes closed. And soon enough, someone sits us down and uses the word autism. And what we found is that he loved the Disney movies with his older brother before the onset. It seemed like the only thing he wanted to do after. He just wanted to watch those movies. So between all the therapies and everything else, that's what he did. He'd rewind movies. So about a year into this silence, Owen is murmuring Juicervos, Juicervos, and we think it's just gibberish. It sounds at least like a baby. And he's watching The Little Mermaid. We're all together. And of course, what scene is he rewinding? The part where Ariel loses her voice, has to make a trade with the Sea Witch to become human. And the Sea Witch says, it won't cost much. It's a trifle, really. Just your voice.
So he wasn't saying Juicervos. He was saying just your voice.
Just your voice.
It won't cost much. Just your voice.
And at that moment, I grab Owen, and we begin a moment of really a journey where we say, maybe he is in there, and maybe he knows what he's saying. This jumps ahead several years. He's almost 7 years old, and he offers his first major sentence where Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan. We say, oh, my God, he's using these movies to make sense of the world, our world. And at that instant, a light went on. That night, I go up to his room. I speak to him in the voice of Gilbert Gottfried. I say in Gilbert's voice, Owen, how does it feel to be you? And what do you say?
Not good, because I don't have any friends.
And I'm lonely. And Owen and I start to talk. It was really the puppet and Owen. After a few minutes of this, Owen clears his throat and says to me what?
I love the way your foul little mind works.
That's Jafar, the villain. Of course, Yaga's the sidekick to Jafar in Aladdin. At that moment, a light goes on. We're speaking in Disney dialogue. We begin years playing animated characters in the basement. Over years, Owen gets his speech back little by little. He learns to read by reading credits and then emerges as a teenager into a kind of genius on animation. And that brings us to this moment where people around the world are saying, wait a second, Of course, he's using his passion as a pathway. It's not a prison. It's a way to understand himself, his place in the world. And that's the story of Life Animated.
And I can't believe I even have to ask this after hearing that story. And this is a story that we've known now for a couple of years as we've read this book. But Roger Ross Williams, what drew you to this story? What is it that you loved about it?
I've known Ron for a long time. I've known him for 15 years. So when he was writing the book, he came to me and said, you know, I think this will make a good documentary. And I jumped on it because this is really about a film about the power of story, about the power of love of one family. And for me, I always saw it as a coming of age story. You know, Owen goes through all the things in the film that we all go through in our life. He graduates from college and he falls in love for the first time. And then he strikes out on his own and becomes independent. And so the film picks up where the book leaves off, and it follows him in this really transformational year of his life.
Owen, what was it like for you to have all these cameras around?
Oh, it was a little uncomfortable at first, but then over time I started to get used to it.
Well, Owen, what do you think about this story of your life and the fact that it's now being told in a book and in a movie and has inspired so many people?
It feels wonderful and fascinating.
Well, let me ask you this, Ron. As you have now followed Owen into adulthood, there are moments in his life that you can't help him with because he's got to be on his own. What has that been like for you? And you obviously get into some of that in this film.
Yeah, well, you know, look, Owen is more and more living his own life out in the world. And part of this movie is about all the things, again, all parents go through, which is letting them go, releasing them. And what's fascinating about us watching the movie is we get to hear the voices of our children, actually, in ways that we don't otherwise hear them through the movie. And it's actually given us even more confidence than we've ever had that Owen will be okay as he goes forward. You know, he's making sense of the world at a very high level, using myth, fable, and legend, using the content he loves, the movies and other things. So actually, it's helped us lessen fears that we once had. And part of it is Owen uses voices that are part of our voices, like just the question you just mentioned, Jeremy. You know, I think that, Owen, would that be the Sebastian scene?
It would definitely be the Sebastian
scene.
Well,
tell Jeremy which scene you use in your head.
At the end of The Little Mermaid, where Sebastian, King Triton discuss Ariel's happy end wish to become human. King Triton says, "She really does love him, doesn't she, Sebastian?" Well, it's like I always say, Your Majesty, children have got to be free to lead their own lives. Like you always say, Sebastian. And I guess there's just one problem left. And what's that, Your Majesty? How much I am going to miss her.
Then I guess there's just one problem left. And what's that, Your Majesty? How much I'm going to miss her.
You know, Jeremy, Owen played that scene for us the night before he left for his college program and really sort of set out into the world. Yeah. And he played that scene. Cornelia and I were in the basement with him. And then he paused it and looked at us and said, "Are we okay?" And Cornelia says, "Of course, honey. We will miss you terribly. But that's because we love you. That's the way it should be. And we're all going to be fine." And Owen said, "Okay, great." And off he went. But you see, he does what all of us do. We find in the mirror of movies, of art, of literature, of the symbolic representations that we create as humans to hold those mirrors up to see ourselves, not just who we are, but maybe who we want to be.
Well, and in this film, you show that he's started a Disney club with others. And I wonder, have you found anyone that has the exact same way of looking at the world and communication through Disney?
Zillions of them.
Zillions. Yeah, zillions. And I still have a few more to meet ahead.
You know, and look, Disney Club, we saw 12 kids just like Owen. 2 years later, there were 40. And this is the way many folks on the spectrum use their passions. They use them as pathways, as code breakers of themselves and their place in the world. And Disney Club, that was great, wasn't it?
It sure was.
Why did you start Disney Club?
To have more people get to know me who are like me.
Did it work?
It sure did.
Owen, what's it like to live on your own now in your own apartment?
Feels good and much better.
And Ron, what is it like for you to watch him be in his own place?
It's exciting. You know, we never knew, Cornelia and I, what to expect going ahead. That's why we often lived in the present with Owen, almost like we were afraid to think of the future too much. Now we see Owen evermore as a captive of his own ship. But look, he will always be an autistic man or a man with autism. You know, this isn't a spell that gets broken. But, you know, ultimately he's now moving his own life forward. And that's very exciting for us to watch.
And Roger Ross Williams, do you have a better understanding now of why this world of Disney worked for Owen? Were you able to learn anything about that as you did this?
You know, when I started this film, I didn't know anyone living with autism. And so my goal is in the film was always to really show the world through Owen's eyes. And I, not only did I learn so much about people living with autism, but I learned that Owen has so much to teach me as a storyteller and as a filmmaker. He made me a better filmmaker making this film. He made me a better storyteller, and it was an enriching experience. And I think when people come to see the film, you know, the film starts out and you may be uncomfortable because you see Owen pacing and talking. But by the end of the film, you know exactly what's going on in his head, and that sort of uncomfortableness has gone away.
You know, somebody, Jeremy, you know, I think years from now, people will say, hey, I thought that kid in that movie was one in a million. And they'll say, no, he's one of a million. They're everywhere. Mm.
Well, the film is called Life Animated. Roger Ross Williams, the director, the executive producer, Ron Suskind, and, of course, Owen Suskind, the star. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Experts are questioning the common wisdom of two routine health practices, the annual pelvic exam for women and those hand sanitizer gels that everyone uses. Sharon Begley is senior science writer with our partner, Stat Science. And Sharon, first to the pelvic exam, feet up in the freezing stirrups. Two things happen there. Are we talking about both the pap smear and the manual exam, or just the manual exam?
It's more the manual exam. So what happened, Robin, is that this group of physicians and other experts who advise the federal government looked at the research on whether the whole kit and caboodle pelvic exam has a benefit for women and does it have any harms. And their basic conclusion was there simply is not enough evidence to say that it benefits women, which is odd considering how many decades it's been a standard part of women's healthcare. All of the claims for it, you know, finding ovarian cysts earlier, finding ovarian cancer earlier, the whole long list, there simply is not research showing that that happens or that it helps women in the long run.
Well, there isn't full agreement on this. As you well know, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists stands by the test.
It does so far, but when I called them for my story this week, they very interestingly seem to be backing away. They acknowledge that there is not research showing that it helps women. Again, this is different from the Pap test, but the Pap test can be done without a pelvic exam. So the Association of Obstetricians and Gynecologists seems to be moving away from its very long-standing hardline position that pelvic exams are beneficial to women. They acknowledge that that is based on what's called expert opinion, which is different from hard science.
Well, and that's the question. What can it ultimately mean? Can it mean that if the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force decides, you know, gee, this doesn't really have a benefit, does it mean that maybe insurance won't cover it? And if you want to still have one, you'll have to pay for it out of pocket.
The task force does advise the government, so it can have an effect on, for instance, whether Medicare pays for it. But for the really controversial questions where the task force has weighed in, specifically on mammograms, and where the task force has dialed back from earlier recommendations, the federal government has said Medicare is still going to cover it, and private insurers have tended to follow suit. On the other hand, if it's no longer covered, it basically costs about $35, so we're not talking about an expensive procedure here.
Well, we think we should note that apparently people can weigh in. You have till July 25th to submit a comment. But one hopes that, you know, the government isn't going to make decisions on things like medical care based on how we all feel about it.
We hope that the experts weigh in, too.
Okay. Hand sanitizers. The FDA says even though these products are everywhere, there's just not enough information about whether they work and whether they're safe. And there's some concern about pregnant women and children and some of the ingredients being found in their blood.
So, Robin, the crucial word in what you just said is everywhere. When these hand sanitizers were introduced, the idea would be that they would be used when people do not have access to soap and water, which is still the best way to clean your hands. But instead, people are using them multiple times a day. They contain ethanol. They contain ethyl alcohol. They contain something called benzalkonium chloride. So these, and that's an antimicrobial, the research does not exist on whether these chemicals are safe for people generally, especially for pregnant women. And the FDA is now saying, show us, produce the evidence that these things are safe because they're so widely used.
Well, the FDA is for now not removing the gels from shelves, but be aware. Sharon Begley, senior science writer with our partner Stat Science. Sharon, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Aaron Bird is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He is with us once again. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, Jeremy. How's it going, man?
It's going well, and let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is the Dutch duo Crack and Smack. This is Hands of Time featuring Alexander London.
We both said goodbye at last. Seasons start to play. Long lost footsteps linger on, but you're not here.
Very interesting. What do you like about this one?
What isn't there to like about it? You know, it's funny. Every time I hear it, I sort of picture myself being in the 1960s, like a stylish spy movie. You know, I just kind of picture James Bond sort of perched on a bar about to order a martini or something. Just really nice, a well-composed tune.
Watch out. And this is going to now be in the soundtrack to the next James Bond movie, but go ahead.
Well, as long as I get some credit, then I'm fine with that. But Crack and Smack is great. I mean, this is their sixth album. They've been around for about 10 years or so now, and I guess it's fair to characterize them as dance producers. So it's nice when they venture out and do something a little bit more mellow and chill, such as Hands of Time.
All right, well, let's get to another one. This is the British singer-songwriter Sam Wills with Unify.
To something, here's the do. Shake all your demons, yeah. Because I'm waiting for you still, just to keep it real. I've lost the sight of you.
Now, Sam Wills cites Michael Jackson and John Legend as influences. That sort of makes sense there from what we're hearing. But what do you hear in this?
I definitely hear that. You know, it reminds me of R&B from the 90s in particular.
Yeah.
It sounds something like Usher would have put out. It's fun. For me, it's nostalgic.
Yeah, me too.
And just a really well-composed pop and R&B song.
Well, what more should we know about Sam Wills?
He spent, this is featured on his debut release, which is So Bright EP. He spent the past 2 years collaborating with several other independent artists and I would say specifically male singers in the underground future soul scene that really harkens back to, again, that sound in the 90s of these R&B male singers.
All right, well, let's get to the next one. This is the British producer Mala. It's called Kotos featuring Asociación Juvenil Puno.
Thank you.
And that instrument you hear there is a panpipe. That's a traditional Peruvian pipe or flute. Amala actually went to Peru to make this album.
Yeah, and he is, as you can tell, sort of with a drum rhythm and pattern, he is a dubstep producer, actually considered sort of one of the pioneers of the genre. And the entire album is really, really great. I mean, he spent a month in Lima, Cusco, and throughout the Sacred Valley collaborating with Afro-Peruvian musicians. And the full-length features traditional instruments that you don't normally hear, such as like percussions from Afro-Peruvian musicians, as mentioned, grassroots tap dancers, Andean sopranos. This one particular song actually features donkey jawbones and dried out pumpkins, believe it or not.
Really?
So it's a really unique collaboration, and I think very well done, especially considering dubstep and traditional Afro-Peruvian rhythms and instrumentations. Otherwise, they're quite alien to one another. So the fact that he was able to successfully combine the two, I think is quite cool.
Well, next, let's head to the north, to the Canadian group Bad Bad Not Good. Here is Time Moves Slow featuring Samuel T. Herring.
I found you at the window again, looking out, watching the leaves falling in. And you were something like a dream.
There's an Al Green quality to that.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. There's that retro soul feel, which has been pretty common over the last couple years. But Bad Bad Not Good, specifically, they're a jazz quartet from Toronto. The three founding members, actually, Matthew, Alexander, and Chester, they all met while attending the jazz program at Humber College, which is in Toronto. And they sort of united through a shared love for hip-hop. And they really made a name for themselves by doing collaborations and remixes and covers of the likes of MF Doom, who was just an underground MC legend, Odd Future. Got this retro soul, almost like a blaxploitation feel to it as well.
What do you mean by that?
It has that feel of the instrumentation with the organ, and actually, now that I'm speaking on it, it sort of reminds me of something that you could play as a DJ. You always think of sort of making these connections. So it reminds me of something that would go really well right after that Crack and Smack song. That sound from the 60s and 70s of the organ, the deep feel, the stack sound from that era of soul music.
The DJ sessions become inside the mind of a DJ, and how you go from one song to the next. And we go to one more here, Aaron Bird. Let's get to the Australian musician Dro Carey. This is Queensberry Rules featuring Kuchka. Say a few years ago, so many of our picks in the DJ sessions came from Australian bands. Haven't heard very much recently, but obviously you have, and this is a good one.
I'm surprised. Yeah, I as mentioned, I remember we had that conversation with one of these sessions,
yeah.
And yeah, I, you know, whatever was in the water then, it still seems to exist now.
As sharks. You mentioned, I think that sharks is the thing that they have in the water.
Some may say. Dro Carey from Perth, and he's been around for a couple of years now, and he just has a really great ability to combine this UK underground house techno electronica sound with pop elements, much like what Disclosure did with Deep House. And though this is quite common amongst British producers, it isn't as common with producers outside of the UK. So it was quite impressive that he was able to pull something like this off. And I think Queensberry Rules is a perfect example of that.
Music from all over the world today from Aaron Burr, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Aaron, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
And you can hear all of our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Markets have been looking up. The three major indexes have gained back more than half of the losses that came after news of the Brexit vote last week. In Europe, stocks and the value of the pound have also been gaining after their dramatic plunge last week that many feared could touch off a global financial crisis. But as we know, what goes down must come up. So what happens when Brexit really takes effect? For a look at that and other news through a financial lens, let's bring in business journalist Ali Velshi. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Robin.
So the CEO of NASDAQ wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that there had been an overblown Brexit market panic. Do you think it was overblown?
Yeah, look, stock market people often tell you it's always overblown, but if we didn't have downs, we wouldn't have ups. I mean, the truth is, historically, stock markets tend to react from things far worse than the potential for Brexit. I mean, if you look back to 9/11, it was not very long before the market had gotten back all its losses. That said, this wasn't about panic. I don't think it's overblown. I think it's the idea that we weren't expecting it. So most investors hadn't figured out what Brexit means to the stocks in which they invest. So I think a lot of people said, let me take my money out until somebody tells me it's safe to go back in. So I don't call it overblown. I think that those are moments when people react, and the stock market is more emotional than sensible sometimes.
Well, and it has so much to do with the economy. I mean, you know, if this does happen, Britain has to renegotiate so many trade deals with different countries, and, you know, it all has to do with finances. But I'm wondering if part of the, you know, the balancing, the calm after that first storm came from sort of exploring the idea that Brexit may not happen.
Yeah, the idea that Scotland and Northern Ireland have both said that they want to remain part of the EU, and that Scotland is calling potentially for another referendum. Now we hear that Boris Johnson, who was one of the leaders of the Leave campaign, is not in the running to become the leader of the Conservative Party. So there's some sense that the UK is having second thoughts. On the other hand, the European leaders are all very interested in getting this thing started and moving quickly so as to send a message to the rest of their membership that if you choose to walk away from the European Union, we're not going to make it easy for you. So I think this is the typical, all right, we've voted, we've gotten over our initial shock and panic. Now what does it actually mean?
Right.
And we're still not, I don't think we're any more certain about any of it than we were on Friday.
Right. The market hates uncertainty, so we may see
yes.
Plunges again. Well, what about the attacks in Turkey? Tourism means so much to that country. We saw them open the Istanbul airport less than a day after the attacks. But how do the markets, how are they viewing that?
Well, so keep in mind, Turkey took a lesson from the Asian airports and the Gulf airports, where it tried to make Istanbul Atatürk Airport a hub for travelers going to points east. And it succeeded in doing so. Turkish Airlines, massive airline. It's a partner with the Star Alliance. It's a partner with United. And it is the place you go to on your way to other places. And they built it into such a great airport that, you know, you'd be comfortable if there were 5 or 6 hours between flights. It's full of boutiques. I've described it as looking like the bar from Star Wars. Hmm. People of every shape and color and dress. Tourism is about 5% of Turkey's economy, and it's a very big economy. So this is a big problem. This is the sixth or seventh attack in Turkey, the third in Istanbul itself in the last year. And as a result of that, there are a lot of cancellations. Travel to Turkey's off 25% this year before this attack. It's obviously going to plummet after this. They wanted that airport up and running as fast as possible to try and reestablish the place at least as a business hub,
yeah.
But it's going to be hard to continue to attract tourists.
Well, you know, of course, obviously the biggest impact of the attack was the loss of life. I mean, you know, it starts
absolutely.
And ends there. But we're talking about financial impacts, and you know, the Muslim world has long known that they are the biggest victims and targets of ISIS. This is that made large. You know, this was largely Muslims. What does that do for the economy?
And I've seen this posted all through social media this morning from people in the Muslim world saying, this is just the face of more to come. This is ISIS, which is getting cornered in its own territory. It's been forced out of Fallujah in Iraq, which leaves only two major centers that it controls, Mosul and Raqqa, its capital in Syria. So I'm sad to say the Muslim world knows this, but the rest of the world knows it too, that we are probably going to see more rather than less of this because it's all ISIS can do now.
Well, and just briefly, Ali Velshi, how do markets, brace for that? Again, the most important thing is human loss. But, there are companies that operate out of airports that those industries must be bracing.
There's nothing worse than for industries that deal with travelers and tourists to have to deal with the uncertainty of terrorism. And that is the uncertainty they're facing right now. But they're realizing that this is something like after 9/11, we all had to think about event risk. Most businesses didn't plan for event risk. Now they're going to have to start planning for it again. If I can put a positive spin on it, I'll say this. This is what we expected ISIS to do as it started to get cornered and pushed out of its territory in the Middle East. At some point, it too will extinguish to the degree that Al-Qaeda has extinguished.
Business journalist Ali Velshi, thank you.
My pleasure.
And I feel the need to say from his lips that is what happens. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.